Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how domestic abusers use the court system to stalk former partners. Sometimes they do it from the other side of a protective order, or even from the confines of a jail cell. But filing lawsuit after lawsuit is a way for violent exes to gain access to the person who left. We'll talk to a journalist for The Atlantic about why being forced into the courtroom to face a former abuser is traumatic and financially draining for the victim, and why so few states have the power to do anything about it. We'll also explore why the justice system doesn't often throw out these abusive lawsuits. Our conversation starts after a short break. Up the courage to leave an unhealthy or abusive relationship, it would seem the hardest part is over. They've managed to move out, to sever ties, to communicate that the partnership is over. But domestic abusers have a tool at their disposal to drag the relationship along, one-sided. The court system. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. By filing lawsuits and appeals, abusers are able to force their ex-partner to show up in court. It's another way to interact with the person who's fought so hard to leave, another way to exert control and influence. And in most states, there's very little that can be done about it. That's what journalist Jessica Klein wrote about in her piece for The Atlantic, headlined, How Domestic Abusers Weaponize the Courts. And she joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Jessica, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Courtney. Thanks for having me.
So, Jessica, the main character in your piece is a woman you identify only by the initial D. What was her relationship with her ex like?
Well, they only dated for about 9 months, and it was hard for her to end the relationship. Though he wasn't physically abusive to her, he was emotionally manipulative, and he would do things like threaten suicide if she left him, sort of classic manipulative abuser behavior. So when she finally was able to break off the relationship, it didn't end there. He started calling her repeatedly, sending her maybe 20 emails a week, also calling her from anonymous numbers, getting his family, even an ex-girlfriend, to call her. So for a long time, it was really very difficult for her to get away from him.
Kind of just sketch out to me, is this I know anecdotal because it's hard to kind of classify abuse category by category, but is this something that happens more than most people think, where it's a relationship that's maybe it's not, nobody's getting hit, nobody's getting hurt or trapped, but at the same time, they feel very unable to leave the relationship or be free?
Yeah, I think it's very common, and makes it even harder, I think, for people to articulate that they're in an abusive relationship, whether it's to friends or family, but particularly to the courts, who probably aren't going to, it's not technically a crime to be emotionally or psychologically manipulative, depending on what you do. I think it's common, and I think it also is, I would say, pretty much always a part of physically abusive relationships as well.
And obviously the reason you're identifying D by the initial is to protect her privacy and her safety. Can you tell us a little bit about the post-breakup harassment, though? Like, what kind of phone calls and texts was she getting?
A lot of them were just calling and hanging up, to the point where, it was hard for her to prove that it was her abusive ex who was calling. But, it kind of got to a point of, who else is this going to be? Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would identify himself, sometimes he wouldn't. I think the text that made her actually go ahead and decide to go to the police and file for a protective order was I spoke to her almost a year ago now, but I think it was he had used his brother's self, or he identified himself as his brother, but it was clear to her that it was him, and he just said something very threatening and menacing. He'd also started sending her emails that showed that he'd been tracking her, that he'd been following what she'd been doing. So that was obviously very concerning. And yeah, that's what kind of prompted her to go ahead and file a protective order.
And you said he was able to contact her from anonymous numbers and also involve his family members. Were they knowingly participating in his contacting her, or was he just using cell phones and numbers and hiding behind them, kind of in theory?
So there were points where they were knowingly participating, but the way she described it is, I mean, I think it's a complicated situation because she acknowledged that she believes he was, you know, kind of, he had mental health issues, and I think his family knew that, and I think he was kind of bothering his own family members, maybe kind of harassing them to get them to call her. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't know this specifically. This is just kind of what she communicated to me based on what she knew about his family. But yeah, so I think it was almost he was pressuring them to contact her for him.
So how did you happen to meet Dee? And why did she want to share her story? This is obviously painful and not even wrapped up completely, but why is it important to her to talk about this?
Yeah, I mean, it even surprised me that she wanted to. I mean, I understood that she wanted to share her story because she figured it was more common than just her. She didn't, she was very upset that it was kind of so easy almost for her ex to use the court system to stay in contact with her for so long. And so I initially found her. I knew that this kind of abusive behavior existed. I knew that a lot of abusers use the court system to continue to stay in their, victim survivors' lives. So I actually, in starting out this story, I reached out to a bunch of, legal aid services that work specifically with intimate partner abuse survivors. And a lawyer from one of them, a service called Sanctuary for Families located here in New York, a lawyer there named Rebecca got back to me and told me she had a client who wanted to go by the NFP, who wanted to get her story out there so that it would stop happening to other people.
So it's interesting to me, the first step kind of that she took legally was trying to file a protective order against this person. And what happened that very first time she tried to file that protective order?
So, I have to kind of look through my paper.
Well, let me kind of rephrase. So she wasn't immediately granted a protective order, right? Because she was told she didn't have all the copies of the threatening texts and phone calls. And you came to learn through your research that she wasn't required to have all that with her. So you'd think it'd be kind of an open and shut thing to get a protective order, but it always isn't always the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on, kind of the police officer who's there, because I know Dee's lawyer told me that you're not supposed to need, like you said, you're not supposed to need copies of, your ex's harassing emails and things. If you want to file a protective order against them, you just need to be able to describe in detail the incidents that are causing you to file. You don't need, actual physical evidence with you.
And so how has this kind of court battle waged on? It seems, like I said, on the outside looking in, you think someone's being stalked or harassed or threatened via phone calls and texts. It should be an easy thing. They should be granted a protective order by the courts, and that's the end of it. Why is that not the end of it?
Yeah, you would think. But it's easy to kind of fight back. So when Dee filed her protective order, her ex-boyfriend... He keeps trying to contest the order. So, which could also, you would think, would be accomplished in just one visit to the courtroom. But it's kind of a dual thing here that's happening now. Or, well, her case is finished for the time being. But so in addition to him just trying really hard to drag out this case and make it go for as long as possible so he can kind of spend as much time in Dee's presence, this is happening in family court, which it's just very busy. So each time Dee has to go to court with her ex, they don't have a lot of time. They maybe have 30 to 45 minutes available before the judge who's trying the case. So, Dee's ex, while he was there in court, he would do things like crying hysterically, just sort of whatever he could to kind of delay the process, which would mean that they wouldn't be able to finish, presenting all the details of the case and everything in their allotted 30 to 40 minutes. So then that means, usually 3 months later, Dee and her lawyer and her ex would have to go back to court and just kind of continue the proceedings.
And that's something I wasn't aware of, that legal proceedings can actually be disrupted and then forced to be continued. You think of it as they're just going to be in the courtroom as long as they need to, but with a full docket, they are time limited. So him bursting into tears or derailing the proceedings means it's not going to end that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, it's gone on for I mean, it was months. I think she started going to court at the end of the summer of 2017, I want to say. Like I said, it's been a while since we spoke. But yeah, it just finished up this past spring. Yeah, that was the last court date she had with her ex. I want to say it was March or April this year.
So a short relationship takes on a whole life of its own when you start involving the courts. And what's that like for the momentum of a case? I mean, if you're presenting evidence and trying to get through something and then an ex-partner is kind of, you know, almost intentionally holding up proceedings, that must make it just difficult for your legal team to do what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think even more than that, it's about the emotional toll it takes on the survivor. I mean, Dee was just trying to get this person, this unhealthy relationship out of her life, and she kind of thought that breaking up would do that, but no, instead it started a process that was like, you know, twice the length of the relationship. And it's, you know, not only an emotional toll, you know, knowing that this is hanging over you, that in 3 months you're going to have to go back to court and see this person again, but it's also a financial toll. I mean, Dee was lucky. I mean, lucky is definitely the wrong word. But she was, you know, she was fortunate in that she, I'll back up, actually. She started going to court by herself to deal with all of this. But I think, you know, a few months into it, she heard about Sanctuary for Families, which is what I told you about, a resource in New York, that legal resource that provides aid to survivors of intimate partner violence. So she went to sort of a free legal screening there. And even though technically because of her income, she didn't fall below the line where New York City would appoint her a free legal representation, she did the screening there and then through Sanctuary for Families was able to get free legal aid for the case. But not everyone is able to do that. And, you know, I've heard stories of survivors having to pay tens of thousands of dollars to, you know, just go to court to continue to deal with abusers who won't let them go.
And it's interesting because it's so one-sided. I mean, there's not a single person, I'm sure, that you could point to that would relish the proceedings going on this way, but it's not as simple. And again, folks on the outside looking in make assumptions that you end a relationship and it's ended, but you can't always just change the locks or block a phone number. Do you think that's a problem of perception? Does the outside world see a relationship end as something that you can control and maybe you can't always do so?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the classic thing you hear in regards to domestic violence relationship is, oh, why don't they just leave? And, you know, there have been statistics around for a while that say when a survivor chooses to leave, that's when it's actually most dangerous for them to be in the relationship because, you know, abuse is about control. So if the abuser no longer has that control because this person, their partner, ex-partner says they're going to leave them, then, you know, they might resort to all kinds of really scary things to make sure that that doesn't happen.
And this is something you can do from jail as well.
Yeah, Rebecca Moy, the Sanctuary for Families lawyer who was representing Dee, she told me about a different client she had who, this is kind of a complicated story.
Actually, Jessica, I want to hear that whole story, so let's save that till after the break and we'll get right back to it. Jessica Klein is a journalist for The Atlantic. Her piece is headlined, How Domestic Abusers Weaponize the Court. I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jessica Klein. She's a journalist with The Atlantic. She's also the co-author of Abetting Batterers, What Police, Prosecutors, and Courts Aren't Doing to Protect America's Women. Her recent piece in The Atlantic is headlined, How Domestic Abusers Weaponize the Courts. And Jessica, before we went to the break, you started to tell a really interesting story about how an abuser is able to even manipulate the court system from the confines of jail. Can you explain that story a bit?
Yeah, sure. So the lawyer I spoke with for this piece, she had a client who her ex was actually incarcerated for attempting to murder her. And so from prison, the abusive ex was trying to seek paternity of, this gets a little complicated, of the lawyer's client's child. So he was basically trying to assert paternity from prison of the client's child, even though he was actually not the biological father. They had only lived together on and off while the client and this man who had attempted to murder her dated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does
make
sense.
Is that too convoluted?
I mean, I don't know if it makes sense is the right way to describe it, but it's very clear what you were saying. So even
right.
though he was not the paternal father, he was trying to assert that he was from jail, which required in and out of court, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you know, he had nothing to gain from this situation. He didn't actually want to be this child's father. He just wanted to continue to harass his ex for as long as he could in the most disturbing ways possible. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty terrible that he was able to get away with that and actually, you know, try to assert paternity for a while.
A really interesting assertion in this piece that kind of got to me as a woman reading this was not only are abusers and former, domestic abuse partners able to interact and see the person they hurt by using the court system, but it also kind of sends a message to the victim survivor that the court system is not a safe space. Why is that so important to understand?
Yeah, well, I mean, in trying to escape from an abusive relationship, you'd want to think that you have law enforcement on your side to help you get out of it, especially when, you know, this person is dangerous and it's not necessarily safe to involve family and friends. So, yeah, I mean, again, abusers are all about having power and control over their victims. So being able to use this one, you know, potential safe haven as actually a weapon, I mean, that's really powerful in a bad way, in a very bad way.
And as we spoke about earlier, the person you feature in this piece, a woman that we identify by the initial D, her abuser wasn't jailed. It wasn't like what you described with the person who's sitting in a jail cell trying to assert paternity. So this is a free man. But what I never really thought through is if the partner that's dragging you into court kind of against your will is not jailed, they're not exactly like kept in separate rooms ahead of proceedings, are they? Are they just hanging out in the hall together?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time they were, and that was another place, another venue for him to try and use intimidation. So he would do things like when he was in the hallway waiting with Dee, he would just bang his head repeatedly against the wall, which is just it's just a disturbing behavior. And you don't want to have to witness that from somebody you're trying desperately to escape from. And I mean, you know, sometimes courts and lawyers and everything can kind of come up with makeshift solutions so that survivors don't have to sit in the same waiting room as their abusers. So I know that sometimes Dee's lawyer would, you know, just make an effort to take her into a separate room prior to court proceedings just so she would have some space. But, you know, just courts are busy and that's not always an option.
We're going to take a phone call now. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-933-5372. Let's go now to Sheree in Dallas. Go ahead, Sheree.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I have left my abuser several years ago, and it has been difficult for me to get any help from foundations where he knocked my front teeth out and caused me to lose our triplets. I have lots of talent trying to move forward and make a living for myself to be self-sufficient, and there has been nothing there. I have called all over the United States and written letters and get no help. So if you can give out some information for me and any other woman, I would truly appreciate it, who really helps women.
That's an interesting point, that sometimes people don't know where to go to seek help or refuge or counsel. Is that something that you've heard anecdotally is a problem for many women?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And especially after this article came out, I had, you know, women from all over the country emailing me saying, I'm experiencing this exact same thing, or, you know, not the exact same thing, but my abuser is using the court to harass and stalk me. I don't know how to get any help. And how can I enact a law like the one that Tennessee has? I hadn't mentioned this yet, but in May of last year, Tennessee signed a specific law that would combat stalking through the courts. So basically, it took effect in July, and it lets judges hold hearings to determine whether a defendant's ex-partner or family member is filing frivolous lawsuits specifically for the purpose of harassing or stalking them. So what that law lets judges do is then prevent these abusers from filing lawsuits for up to 7 years following that first sort of court stalking offense. So, so I just got women from different parts of the country being like, how can I make sure a law like this comes to my state? And unfortunately, you know, there's not a great answer to this. I think usually, you know, the first step that I would recommend is trying whatever, you know, is approaching whatever sort of local domestic or sexual violence organization is available near you. It's not the most satisfying answer, unfortunately, but it's definitely a good place to start, and then the people there could hopefully connect you with local resources. And then, you know, just also kind of, yeah, I don't know. It's a tough question.
And our caller, Sheree, was very brave to share kind of the details of some of the physical abuse she underwent.
Yeah.
And this is not one woman's story. This is something you hear over and over again, whether it is physical abuse, prolonged physical abuse, emotional abuse. You know, we've even done some reporting around financial abuse where a woman feels she's held captive mm-hmm. by having no money or resources to leave. Domestic abuse and intimate partner violence really does kind of run the gamut as far as what's happening to the victim, but it doesn't make accessing services any easier depending on what happened.
Yeah, no, it really doesn't. I mean, and especially, you know, if you're located in a rural community, you might not have a, you know, any kind of domestic violence help center or legal aid available. And if you're in a small community, you know, your abuser might be really integrated with the town. They might know local law enforcement. They might be local law enforcement. So it's not necessarily safe to engage with law enforcement when the person who's abusing you has, you know, some kind of relationship with local police officers.
And we've been talking about this all along, about how people can use the court system as a weapon. Can you kind of define what vexatious litigation or litigation abuse actually is for people that are kind of new to this topic?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it has a lot of names. So there's abusive litigation, vexatious litigation, paper or separation abuse, you know, called separation abuse because it often takes place when a couple is trying to separate or divorce. And also stalking by way of the courts, which is, I think stalking by way of the courts is actually a very helpful way to describe it, because perpetrators will basically file, you know, frivolous lawsuits, ones that aren't actually, you know, there's not actually something bad that's happening to them that this that their victim is doing. It's just a way for them to get access to them through the courts. So it's just repeatedly filing lawsuits or protesting protective orders over and over again to the point where you just ensure that your victim is in the same room with you in the courtroom, you know, long after the relationship itself ends.
And as we've touched on a bit already, and our caller kind of brought this point to light, saying it's really hard to figure out where to go for help. If you are being dragged into court and it's not really your idea, or maybe it was your idea to start with, but you certainly had no plans to come back again and again and again to be contested or appealed, you may not have a lawyer at your disposal. And we talked about this a bit earlier. How hard is it to figure out how to navigate these legal proceedings on your own? Do many people know where to go in the first place, even if they're lucky enough to eventually find pro bono help? I'm guessing a lot of them start on their own.
Yeah, I think most of them start on their own, and I think it's very difficult to navigate. I mean, I personally, I would have a hard time navigating it, and I've, you know, done some research into this. But yeah, I mean, I think it's very difficult. And also, when you're speaking to kind of an authority figure and you're told that you need something, you need to do something, or that, you know, your case isn't that important, you're kind of likely to believe that because they're an authority figure. I mean, we mentioned this earlier, but when Dee first went to file a protective order against her abusive ex, the police officer basically, or the judge, the first judge that she saw to get the protective order, said that she needed all this physical evidence in order to be able to successfully file. And that just wasn't true, but she didn't know that until she had a lawyer by her side who could tell her that you didn't need to do that.
And some people
And then...
Oh, continue, please.
Oh, Sorry, I hope you don't hear too much shuffling paper.
That's fine. So she, the first time she was there, she was on her own, and she was told, bring us the evidence, you're not getting the protective order. But if she had had that lawyer next to her, they would have said, no, this isn't so, and it probably would have gone a different way.
Yeah, exactly. And then there are other kind of ways that you can fight back against abusive litigation in the courtroom that, you know, probably most people wouldn't know about. There's some, you know, there are tort claims, which are used to fight harmful actions that don't quite qualify as crimes, which could be, you know, filing frivolous, harassing lawsuits. Mm-hmm. But I spoke to one lawyer. His name is Joel Kurtzberg here in New York, and he told me, often victims don't know what their options are or don't have the wherewithal to bring the action without somebody representing them who knows the law. So, I mean, I feel like that just summed up very well, you know, how lost you can be in a really complicated legal system.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. And as you said, not having a lawyer next to you or not having one next to you at first can be detrimental to your case. But if you don't luck into a pro bono program or having, you know, a nonprofit point you in the right direction for some free representation, you really can get seriously into debt as far as these legal proceedings go. And there was someone in the article mentioned who had racked up six figures in debt.
Yeah, so this was actually a case that was discussed by the Tennessee representative, Mike Carter, who sponsored Tennessee's law that combats stalking by way of the courts. So before he was a representative, he was an attorney and a judge. And in his time working, he encountered an abusive lawyer. The guy's name, I want to say it was, oh yeah, Fred Wortman III. So this guy went for prison for trying to murder his wife at the time three separate times. So he tried to kill her three times. And even from jail, he continued to file lawsuits against his ex-wife. And he was mainly able to do this because they had shared children. So, you know, I'm assuming it had something to do with custody or visitation rights. But because of all of these lawsuits he continued to file, Wortman's ex-wife, who was a teacher, ended up owing more than $100,000 in legal fees. And, you know, on any salary, that's tough, but on a teacher's salary, it's especially difficult.
And that points to another interesting point, is that if you make teacher money, which is certainly a living, but not enough cushion maybe to have an attorney on retainer, you're probably not going to qualify for some free legal aid programs.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, we discussed this earlier, but, you know, has a steady job, a decent salary, but, you know, it technically fell above the line in New York that, you know, that you need to fall below in order to automatically get free representation in court. But she still wasn't making the kind of money where she could just afford to go to court every third month for, you know, a couple of years.
And one thing I thought about, I primarily cover poverty outside of when I'm hosting this show. And something that I've heard again and again is it's not always the cost of something. It's also the poverty of time. I imagine even if you've got the representation, if you have to constantly take time off work or arrange strange childcare, that can really cut into your financial and emotional well-being, too, just to show up.
Yeah. And I mean, in Dee's case, you know, she didn't have a children who she had to deal with or anything, but she had a full-time job and she didn't want to tell any of her coworkers or her boss about what was going on. Understandably, I mean, not everyone wants to share that kind of just like really terrible personal stuff going on in their lives. So, you know, I think it was tough for her to have to kind of continually create these reasons to not be at work that, you know, she didn't want to say why she wasn't coming into work, but she still had to leave. So then that potentially looks bad and can put your job in danger. I mean, I know when I was speaking with her, she was still employed and it was fine, but it wasn't easy.
No, and I'm sure it made her uneasy as well. For people that don't have paid time off, that actually affects their finances. If they're taking a day of unpaid leave, that's a day of lost wages.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's interesting that you brought up her, you know, unwillingness to share this because it's deeply personal. So again, I mean, once the relationship ends, you think it's over. But if it turns into a years-long in and out of court battle, it does kind of jeopardize you in different ways as far as having to air your personal business to people you might not be willing to. Is that something that this does as well? It doesn't just give the abuser FaceTime with his victim survivor or her victim survivor in court, but it also kind of allows that person to seep into different cracks in their victim's life?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. I mean, I guess it kind of forces you to have to continue to not just see that person, but talk about that person and have them be very present in your life. And, you know, even if the protective order is active and the abuser is actually obeying it and not contacting you, they're still kind of seeping into your thoughts because you know, oh, next time, this same time next week, I'm going to have to see this person in court, or how am I going to get the money or the babysitter to be able to make this next court appearance? I mean, it's really all-consuming when you're involved in a prolonged legal battle like this.
Do you think it ever makes people give up? Like, why bother renewing the protective order? I just don't want to go through it again.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some cases people probably don't have a choice because it's so complicated and there's so many different ways that abusers abuse. But, I'm sure a lot of people just give up.
We're speaking this hour to Jessica Klein. She's a journalist with The Atlantic. Her piece is headlined "How Domestic Abusers Weaponize the Courts." Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jessica Klein. Her piece in The Atlantic is headlined "How Domestic Abusers Weaponize the Courts." And I think we're going to go right to a call now. We're going to hear from Charlie in Dallas.
Thank you for this show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for the guest is, what is the recourse for the victims of abuse when the abusers are the authorities themselves, such as police officers?
Interesting question. Jessica, what do you think?
That is a good question. It's really difficult. I mean, I think then maybe it's not safest to go directly to law enforcement if the abuser works in that specific precinct. If you're, if you're in a big city and there are a lot of precincts, then you don't think that, the abuser will be as connected with a precinct that's all the way downtown. If you're all the way uptown and you feel confident that they don't really know people personally there, then maybe that's an option. But, word can always get back to an abuser within a city or town or county police department. So in that case, I mean, I think the best thing to do is probably contact or go to a domestic violence shelter or some kind of other service that isn't related to law enforcement and tell them that story and kind of get their advice on where you can go from there.
And I think we'll take one more call now. John in Dallas. John, you can go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I had a situation where the perpetrator was a female and I had a protective order filed against her. I was told by her probation department that if I felt threatened at all, to contact them. And there were instances where things were dropped off in my mailbox. I had physical evidence. And I contacted them every time I felt threatened, because that's the word they used, if I felt threatened. I go back to court to renew the protective order for the third time. And the probation officer, who was male, who had been visiting with her in her home once a week, got up and testified against me, saying I was out to get her. So it's frustrating both ways. It's certainly intimidating to be a female, and it's also very frustrating to be a male on the receiving end of that. And I just wanted to share that story because it happens both ways.
I think we may have lost our connection with John, but he does make a good point. We have a shelter here in the Dallas area specifically for men who are victims of abuse and harassment. Is that something you hear? Are men taken less seriously if they have a claim?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky issue. I think most people talk about abuse in terms of, you know, women being abused by men because that has just historically been a lot more common. But yeah, and I mean, I think another thing that isn't discussed very much is abuse taking place in same-sex relationships or queer relationships of any kind. I mean, yeah, abuse can, you know, it can happen between sort of any, or not between, sort of any type of abuse or any type of relationship can be susceptible to abuse. And I think, you know, it's just about finding, like you said, there is a shelter in Dallas that caters specifically to male survivors. I think it's about finding services that are going to work best for you if you have that option. But yeah, I mean, I'm also glad he brought that up, because I think another myth is that's kind of perpetrated in courts that I've heard about a lot is that courts always rule in favor of the mother in terms of child custody cases. So, but that's not true. Rebecca Moy, the lawyer I spoke with primarily for this piece, was telling me that actually judges generally fight to provide, to keep both parents in the lives of children. So in cases where there's one abusive partner, you know, regardless of their gender, that's pretty difficult, because a lot of the time, you know, the courts won't really look at history of abuse or won't take it very seriously, because they're going to prioritize giving the child a relationship with both parents.
One interesting thing that I read in your piece that stuck with me was the idea that abusive fathers are more than twice as likely as non-abusive fathers to petition for sole custody. Why is that?
Again, I think it's another tactic of exerting control. If you're not abusive, then you probably just want to see your children because you love your children and you want to see them and you want the best for your children, which means you also probably want the other parent to remain in their lives. If you're an abuser, then, you know, you care about control, and filing for sole custody is a way that you know that you'll be able to, you know, really get at and disturb your victim.
You point out that family court can often attract the newer judges. Why is that, and why can that be problematic when trying to handle something like this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was kind of just told that it's not as prestigious of a position. I mean, personally, I can't really speak to that, but that's what I learned sort of in the course of my reporting. And I think there's just like a very high volume of cases that go through every day. So, yeah, it's kind of overwhelming. There are a lot of different cases on a single judge's docket, and for them to be able to sort of keep track and follow the thread of one survivor's story, especially when, like Dee, they're only coming back to court every third month of the year, I think it's really hard to do that. And, you know, also courts in, you know, different counties or just different locations in general, they're not the best at sharing information. So if an abuser has a history of domestic violence offenses, that might not be known to the judge who's trying them in one particular state if those former offenses took place in another state.
We talked about this earlier in the show, but I would like to make sure that people that have joined us later understand kind of the big step that Tennessee took and is the only state to have done exactly this. Can you tell us what the law that Tennessee passed and why it's distinct from what other states have right now in the books with teeth?
Yeah, sure. So Tennessee in May 2018 signed a law that was specifically meant to target stalking by way of the courts, so this vexatious litigation that we're talking about. And it took effect in July of that same year, last year. And basically, it lets judges hold hearings to determine whether a defendant's ex-partner or family member is filing a lawsuit, a frivolous lawsuit that's specifically intended to harass the person who they're filing it against. So if in the course of those hearings, a Tennessee judge decides that it is a harassing lawsuit, then they can prevent those abusers from filing lawsuits against that person for up to 7 years following that first incident.
In states that don't have a lot on the books or not as much targeted, you know, law on the books, what do they do? Do they apply laws that were intended to be applied elsewhere? I mean, how did they kind of get creative? I know you had a really interesting example of a Kentucky judge that came up with kind of a solution to stop someone from jail from repeatedly trying to drag himself and his former partner into court.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of goes back to what we were saying with the whole child custody issue. Abusers will do a lot of things just for the sake of harassing their victim survivor. So this judge had come up with, I think there was an abuser who wanted to take their victim to court. And so cleverly, this judge said, how about we have you just do the hearing by video? So that, you know, we don't have to bother you guys, neither of you have to come in, kind of knowing that if she said that, he would be less inclined to want to follow through. And I believe she was right. I believe he didn't actually care about really having that, you know, filing that motion or whatever it was. He just wanted to be in the same room as his victim survivor. So, yeah, so things like having abusers call in or have them attend a court appearance via video. Those are things that kind of might discourage them from filing frivolous lawsuits because those frivolous lawsuits, the main point for them is to actually get to be in the same room as the victim.
Is it sometimes tough for judges to distinguish between the frivolous claims and legitimate ones, especially if there's kids or shared property involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think divorces can be contentious without being abusive. So especially, you know, if it's you're sitting as a judge in family court and you're just overwhelmed all day with couples fighting or, you know, I don't know. I think it's definitely going to be hard for you to tell if a couple's relationship is really unhealthy in an abusive way or just, you know, bad because they're going through a divorce or trying to split up property or determining child custody rights. So, yeah, and especially, you know, when you're in family court and you only get to see a certain case for 30 minutes at a time and you don't really have the time or the bandwidth to get a full backstory on what's going on. And, you know, you're just seeing these people in a room together for 30 minutes in the context of court. It's definitely hard to tell whether there is a history of abuse there. Especially, like I said earlier, when courts don't necessarily, when judges don't necessarily get all the information of, you know, abusers' past criminal charges and things like that.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Do prolonged legal proceedings ever kind of trap victim survivors in place? Does it make it impossible for them to move or take a new job elsewhere because they have to continually be at close access to being dragged into court? Is that something that's a problem?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's something Dee was talking about. I mean, she didn't specifically want to move out of New York immediately. But, you know, when we met about a year ago, she was telling me that she definitely has dreams to, you know, she lived in New York all her life and she has dreams to kind of move somewhere else and experiencing something outside of the city grind, I think was kind of how she put it. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, she couldn't leave while the trial was still ongoing because she knew that she had to be back in court every 3 months, approximately. And she was also worried that if she leaves, so now she has a protective order, one that extends for the next 3 years. So she's hoping that kind of keeps her ex from contacting her. But, you know, it's only 3 years. So even if she moves away, she's concerned. She said, you know, he was kind of a savvy guy. So she was concerned that if she moves away, that he would learn the laws of whatever, you know, state she moves to and figure out a way to get around them to get in contact with her again.
And that kind of persistence is almost impossible to really grasp if you've never been in this situation. I mean, who would think that someone is capable, after dating someone for 9 months, of, you know, relocating themselves and learning state law to harass someone in a new state? But it does happen.
Yeah, really. I mean, you would think that they would get tired or lose steam, but especially for this person, she said that he didn't really have very many friends. You know, his relationship with his family was a little bit strained, and I don't think he had a job when, you know, in the time that she was talking to me about him. So, you know, he didn't have much to lose, and he was just very fixated on her. So, yeah, I mean, you're not kind of dealing with your average person who's going to get busy or preoccupied with other things. This was this guy's, you know, it's his life. This was like his main hobby. It was kind of just harassing her.
We talked a lot about how money can stack up with legal proceedings. Time off from work can be stressful, trying to arrange childcare. But we haven't talked too much about just the emotional toll of being stuck in that court loop. How does that re-traumatize victims of abuse?
I mean, it does, right? If you have to be put in front of the person who's, you know, abused you in the past, especially if they're doing things like Dee's ex did, which was, you know, bang his head repeatedly against the wall while they were both waiting next to each other outside to get into the court to, you know, start their hearing with the judge. You know, that action would definitely kind of make her think of all the times he threatened to commit suicide because she was saying that she was going to leave him. I mean, it's just, there are just so many opportunities to, I mean, opportunities feels like a bad word for it, but there are just so many opportunities to be re-traumatized in this kind of situation when you're just forced to be with somebody who abused you before.
Is
continuing to.
Of course. A 3-year protective order is something. Does she feel like she's been able to get back to her life at all, or is she still just in the habit of constantly, like, freezing when the phone rings or looking over her shoulder all the time or worrying about unknown numbers?
You know, that's a good question. I actually haven't spoken to her since I've only been speaking with her lawyer. But I know that one of the things her lawyer told me at the time for Dee and all of her other clients who have abusers who were using the court system to harass them, but she said that she kind of fears that it's actually going to just be hard for them to move on and sort of process what happened even after the legal proceedings end. Because, I mean, yeah, it's great that she got the protective order, but again, you know, it's not forever.
My guest this hour was Jessica Klein, journalist with The Atlantic. Her piece is headlined, How Domestic Abusers Weaponize the Courts. She's also co-author of Abetting Batterers, What Police, Prosecutors, and Courts Aren't Doing to Protect America's Women. Jessica, thank you so much for your time. What an interesting conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Courtney.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERAThink. You can also subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, and today for Chris Boyd, thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.